let's review the schedule a little bit. Woo, moving on. So right now we have 3:15 to 4 o'clock. We're going to go over steps 5 through 8. And then 4:10 to 5 o'clock, we're going to go over step 9. And then I will be done for the day, and you're going to come back after dinner, and Larry Kay is going to be up speaking from 7 to 8 o'clock. There's a campfire, around the campfire with Jerry R. and Jerry G. And then OA campfire meeting from 10 to 11. My goodness, it's a lot of work. Okay, so we've now gone through steps 1 through 4, and we're starting in the chapter Into Action. So once again, the pace is going to really start picking up now. How It Works had steps 2 and 3 and 4. Into Action has steps 5 through 11 in it. So the momentum is building. I'm going to tell you something that I do. This is not big book. One of the things I have found useful is when I start the instructions on step 4, I make a step 5 appointment with my sponsees. Because step 4, it can be very uncomfortable. And if you know when it's going to be over, you know how long you're going to have to be uncomfortable. Once again, my friend Maria Kay, who says, I'm going to let them know how long they're going to have to be in the poopy diaper. Personally, for me, I give them 7 to 10 days, and that's it. I only take fifth steps on the weekends, so it's depending on when we're starting. I give them 7 to 10 days. Because once again, this is not about writing your life history. This is what's on your mind right now. Let's get it out there. Let's move forward. Let's get you a spiritual awakening, and then you can use your 10 and 11 to clean up anything else. So if we go to page 72, and I'm going to just kind of cherry-pick the next few pages because a lot of this work for step 5 is telling people how to pick someone to give their step 5 to. And that is because back when this book was written, they were assuming that someone from Colorado was going to call the office in New York and have a book mailed to them, and they would not have access to recovered people. So they're trying to tell the person, what kind of person are you looking for to take your step 5? We are so blessed today. We have recovered people who understand what the fifth step is about that can take our inventories. And even if we're in an area that maybe that a lot of people don't do the big book in OA, we can go to AA meetings and see if someone in AA can take our fifth step. So let's look at that first, the second full paragraph on page 72. So this is perhaps difficult. About 4 lines down. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. I don't know about you guys, but that was an excuse I would use. Well, you know, it says, you know, before God, you know, myself, God, and another human being, 2 out of 3 is good enough for me. I don't know if anyone's ever, any guys have sold houses, I'm sure, right? If you're going to sell your house, you don't set the price of what you're going to sell your house for, right? You get what's called a third-party appraiser. Because someone, you know, your house is your home. And you, like, for example, with me, I have dogs. I have original hardwood from the 1920s that's in really crappy shape from all the nails. But I don't care. I have dogs. But someone coming into my house is just going to see crappy floors. Maybe in the upstairs bedroom, you have a bunch of scratches on a door frame saying how tall your kids are as they grew. But all the person coming and buying your house is just going to see a bunch of scratches on your door frames. So a third-party appraiser comes in and say, okay, Kim, you have a 3-bedroom house, 2 baths, crappy floors, you live in this school district in New Jersey, property taxes are a huge thing, this is how much your property taxes are for, this is how much you can sell your house for. And that's valuable information for me, for someone who wants to sell a house. That's the benefit of step 5. I cannot be objective about my life. But someone who is outside of that can be objective. It's the same exact thing in step 10. I need to have people who can be objective about my life take my step 10. Me staying in my own head is very, very dangerous. So let's go to page, actually put another one. Here's a warning. I love the warnings in the big book. So 5 lines up from the bottom on page 72. We might want to skip this vital step. It says, the best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Which is why I feel a lot of people who stay in their four step winds up picking up because they're not getting through the step work quickly enough. It says, trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods, almost invariably get drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wonder why they fell. That's why I truly believe the Big Book, and I think the Big Book supports it, but I do know people who feel differently, is I have to do these steps totally sober. If I pick up, I have to go back to step one. I need to have a new experience with step one to understand my unmanageability, which will propel me to get through these steps. If I am still eating and I'm trying to do these steps, I don't have the clarity of a mind to do it. You know, I remember, this is years and years ago, I was watching a TV show and they had a bunch of people drinking. Not alcoholics, but just a bunch of people drinking. And they said all of a sudden, everybody stop. How many of you think that you can drive? And like 80% of the people raised their hand. And they gave them breathalyzer tests, and 80% of them were over the legal limit. And like I said, not alcoholics. They were just people, they were so upset. Oh my God, if I had gotten on the road, I could have hurt somebody. Because the alcohol made them feel good, and they didn't understand that they were impaired. To me, it's the same thing with the food. I don't understand I'm impaired while I'm eating because it, may, quote unquote, makes me feel good, or my senses are dulled. So I need to have that mind cleared through the entire process in order to get the benefit. And I have to tell you, that ticked me off in the beginning when I heard that clear message, but it ultimately made me feel happy because I was like, okay, that's why the steps weren't working. They weren't working because I was encouraged to do the steps in order to get abstinent. And then I would think the steps didn't work. Well, the basic instruction is I have to be sober first, and since I wasn't paying attention to that direction, all the other directions weren't working. So if we go to page 73 again, the first full paragraph, these two paragraphs are fabulous. And I'll tell you, I'll also talk about it. They're fabulous for me as a recovered person. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. He is the one he likes his fellows. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. My basic philosophy of life was, I might think I'm a piece of crap, but if I can make you believe I'm worthy of something, then I'm okay. And literally, not the same roommate, but another roommate in college called me the chameleon. And I thought it was a compliment. Because I learned as a child, you become what people want they want you to be, and they won't leave you. So I would figure out what people wanted, got quiet in the corner, like I told you, figure out what people wanted, and I would become that. So depending on who came to my dorm room, I would become a totally different person. So I wasn't leading a double life, I was leading a quadruple, quintuplet life. Ooh, pages turned. And the thing was, I knew I didn't deserve it. I can get that way in Overeaters Anonymous. That's why I picked up when they wanted me to be World Service Trustee. People were expecting me to do something I knew I wasn't capable of. And it scared me to death. So it says here, the inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more drinking. So personally, I have not had a food spree in over 7.5 years. But I've had anger sprees. I've had resentment sprees. So as a recovered woman, I think to myself, what are the sprees that I'm still going on? Because I'm not going towards my step work with different parts of my life. And I'm not going to, and I'll tell you, I'm revolted by the way I behave in my anger sprees and my fear sprees. And if I continue that behavior, I'm going to be under constant fear and tension, and it's going to lead to more drinking. It's going to lead to more eating. So this is not just appropriate to me in step five to make us understand why we have to get rid of this inventory, but it's also beautiful for us, for those of us who are recovered, who are trying to live a certain way in Overeaters Anonymous and act like we don't have problems. You know, that's one of the things, you know, we keep talking about this vision meeting, but I hear people all the time who call me, well, you guys all have perfect lives. I'm like, yeah, I can hold it together for a 3-minute share. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, that's not who I am. I'm constantly falling apart. You know, but if I want people to think of Kim G from South Jersey, that's scary. That's scary to live up to that. If you're your inner group chair or you're one of the elders in the meeting and you want to act like you don't have problems, first of all, you're not being helpful because you're giving people unrealistic expectations. But you're also endangering your own sobriety. We're always going to be human beings. That's why we grow towards these ideals. Okay, so let's go to page 75. So now we've done this inventory, we've done all our columns, right? It says we decide to hear who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have written an inventory and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner that we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged on a life and death errand. Do I get that? Do I get him on a life and death errand? Do I get that as the person hearing the fifth step as much as I get it as the person giving the fifth step? That is the most sacred thing we do, in my opinion, in Overeaters Anonymous, is take someone's fifth step. Are we treating it that way? You know, and it talks a lot about here how finding people to do that, and this is my opinion again. But I want to give you an example. When I was recovering from my ankle injury, and it took me a full year to be able to, I wasn't even allowed to walk on grass for the first 9 months. And I remember asking the doctor at one point, you know, when can I run? And he's like, well, I didn't know you were a runner. I said, oh, no, like when it's raining out and I'm in the grocery, got to go to the grocery store, when can I run from my car into the house? That's what I really wanted to know. But he said to me, he laughed. He said, listen, because I'm an orthopedist. He said, I hate running. Running is really, really bad for the skeleton. He said, but I know you also have a heart condition. And I'm sure if you talk to your cardiologist, he's going to want you to run because it's really, really good for your heart. So it was just an idea, depending on where their focus is, was going to be where their opinion was. This fourth and fifth step is very specific. We're trying to find freedom. We're trying to identify those character defects, those patterns in our life that are keeping us stuck. Often when you go to psychologists, they're trying to figure out your childhood. Often when you go to a religious person, they're trying to find forgiveness. I just think it's very useful to have someone who's had the experience in a 12-step work, so they're guiding you through the 12 steps versus someone that has a different slant or a different objective on there. And specifically, too, if you're picking someone, a family member that could be hurt because you don't want to tell someone away. Because a lot of times we don't want to tell someone away because we know they're going to call us on our crap. And it's a lot easier to go to a religious person who's just going to listen to us and go, don't worry about it, honey. But that's just my personal opinion. I think it's really important that we go to someone who's recovered, who understands the skill set that can help us through this process. So now we have what's called the fifth step promises. It says we pocket our pride and go to it. Now, I did not think of this until I heard a woman say it on a podcast a few months ago. She goes, it doesn't say we get rid of our pride, we pocket it, which means we're going to pull it out again. We're human. So for right now, we're going to pocket our pride, eliminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken the step withholding nothing, we are delighted. I definitely felt lighter. All these secrets, all these things that I thought people didn't know about me, and I told someone, and they didn't laugh, and they didn't run away, and in most cases they said, yeah, I did that. I felt lighter walking out of that room. Actually, I was laying in bed with my ankle up and talking to somebody, but here's the biggest one for me. We can look the world in the eye. Because what I didn't realize is I never looked anyone in the eye. Because you see, when I had to be that chameleon, I was so busy trying to remember who I was supposed to be in front of you and what lies I had told you. And as you're talking, I'm trying to think of what I can say to you to impress you, to make you like me. How the heck did I have time to look you in the eye? And I go through this process and I realize, you know, apparently being Kim is enough. And I can start paying attention to you and what you're saying, and I can look you in the eye. This is also a great promise because when I get stressed out, I start to notice I don't look people in the eye. And it's a little sign that there's some inventory work and I'm getting a little bit jammed up and I need to do some work because I'm starting not to do that again. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Gotta tell you, I still struggle with that. I'm somebody that throws a TV on and a radio on the second I walk into a room. But I can sit still. I was telling some people at lunch, I started doing yin yoga, which is, my yoga teacher calls it sloppy yoga. And basically you hold these poses, and it's, I think that the elevations bother, my hips are really bothering me. But it helps, you know, like, get the fascia and stuff out of your joints and everything. And you sit in a position for like 5 minutes. That is such a great spiritual practice for me to sit in one position for 5 minutes. And what I've done is I've taken the third step prayer, and for the first pose, I'll say, God, I offer myself to thee, and get quiet with that line. The second pose, I might say, build with me and do with me as I will. I started recently picking chapters. Okay, this class I'm going to do the doctor's opinion. Let me think about the effect. Where am I getting the effect from that's not God? So how do I get quiet, a peace and ease? And it's again, a process. It's a big thing for me to sit still for 5 minutes personally. Our fears fall from us. Once again, when I started to realize my fear and what I thought was going to happen were not linked, a lot of them started to fall from me. We begin to feel the nearness of the Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. For me, I see people do a variety. I see people who are atheists who become believers. I see people who are believers become atheists. I see people with a specific idea of God get a more global idea of God. I see people who have a global idea of God gravitate towards a very specific idea of God. You know, for me personally, I knew I didn't have to go to Morristown, New Jersey on Sunday morning at 11:15 a.m. to talk to a higher power. I started to see these 12 steps and a higher energy in so many different things. That's when I really became a spiritual seeker and started to read books and started to ask people questions. I've always been curious. I mean, when I went to college, once again, Catholic school, I remember meeting a Jewish person going, can you tell me about it? And I remember her saying one time, you know that Jesus was Jewish, right? Like, I'm like, oh, so the Last Supper was actually, you know, Passover? Oh, my God, never knew. And I remember there was a guy across the hall from me who was Muslim, and I would go, because I was so, it wasn't in a mean way, I was just so curious about people who their experiences were different than mine. And I'm still that way. What does a Buddhist think? What do all these different practices mean? I find them so fascinating. It doesn't mean I have to agree with them or I have to adopt them, but my curiosity is there. How do other people find spiritual experiences? And what that does for me, I think, is make me a better sponsor. Because it helps me. I often crack up when people, after we get through the steps, they say something and they assume I'm the same religion that they are. Because I try to keep it as generic as possible, because I don't want them to follow me. I want them to find their own path. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand in the spirit of the universe. Honestly, for me, it wasn't until I started doing my step nines that the drink problem started to go away. And I just want to mention that because I think sometimes we think we have to get 100% on this test in order like to go on. So and one of the things I do with my sponsees is I have them use this as meditation for a week to make sure they're starting to come true. Because to me, recovery is not a light switch, it's a dimmer switch. So we're going to start to feel these little awarenesses coming on and coming on. So don't panic if you're not feeling everything. And being on that broad highway, which is capitalized, my experience was I started to feel a part of Overeaters Anonymous. I started to feel a part of my family. I started to feel a part of my friends, where I really thought, you know, I was always thinking everybody was out to get me. So I started to feel a part of as opposed to separate from. Now, I just want to say, a year or so ago, I love when somebody says something which is my experience, but I never had it put into words. And this guy, Ricky, said, you know, you don't just get to experience these fifth steps when you give one, you get to experience them when you take one. And I didn't realize that. I mean, I realized it, but I didn't get to put it into words. Every time I take a fifth step, I get to experience these promises over and over again. I have to tell you, the first 17 years in OA, I probably took five fifth steps at the most. I now average one or two a month. Don't deprive yourself of this. It is an absolute high to be taking fifth steps. I remember when I first started recovered, and there was a girl in an AA meeting that said she didn't feel like a member of AA until she took 25 fifth steps. First of all, I thought that was nuts. secondly, I'm thinking, who the heck takes 25 fifth steps? That's insane. I take 50 a year. I mean, I could easily take 30, 40 a year. That is the gift you're giving yourself by taking these fifth steps. Often when I'm feeling a little bit restless, irritable, discontent, I'll say to myself, when's the last time I took a fifth step? Because that's the juice. That's the high. That's the buzz that we get from doing this work. So now let's go to that next paragraph. So we've now given our fifth step, and we're given some instructions. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart. We know Him better. I call this the fifth step prayer. I thank God from the bottom of my heart. I know Him better. Why is that? Because we acknowledged in step three that we're blocked, and now we're starting to remove those blocks. So I will often use this as a step 10 prayer. Because what do you do in step 10? You're removing blocks. And every time I do a step 10, I'm removing yet another block between me and my higher power. Carefully reviewing the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch to which we shall walk a free man at last. So the first five proposals are the first five steps. So I tell my sponsees to go home and think about it. Do you believe you're a compulsive overeater of the type described in this book? Do you believe you have the allergy? Do you believe you have the mental twist? Do you believe you need a higher power step two? Are you committed to this decision to go through with the rest of the work? And then in four and five, have you purposely not told me something? Not that you haven't thought, you know, told me your whole entire life and that something comes up. But if you're purposely not telling me something, that's a problem. Now, what I do is, you know, I know a lot of people like, well, it's an hour. It's supposed to be a full hour. What I personally do for me is I tell them, do this. And when your mind starts getting distracted, call me. So whether that's 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, or an hour, just don't take more than an hour. So if I'm doing it face-to-face, often what I'll do is, because they'll come to my house, I'll go walk my dogs for like, you know, 30, 40 minutes and come back. But if it's on the phone, then I just tell them to call me when they're ready. And then we go into 6 and 7. So on the top of page 76 is the first paragraph is step 6, the second paragraph is step 7. So it says, if you can answer to your satisfaction, then we look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from all of us the things which we have admitted are objectionable. Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. The word that always jumps out to me is objectionable. Because if you had asked me prior to doing this work, Kim, what are some of your good qualities? I would have said, well, I'm self-sufficient, I can pull myself up my bootstraps, I'm pretty independent. And I find out through this process, those are some of my biggest defects. My self-sufficiency is what's killing me. So I don't know what's objectionable until I do this work. And then we have the seven-step prayer. When ready, we say something like this, my creator. Now, I even love that. I love these generic words for God. And the way that I love that is because, see, I create chaos. And if I create chaos, I'm going to need another creator. So my creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. So I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. So what that means to me is I'm not going to figure it out anymore. I don't know what's good. I don't know what's bad. I'm going to turn everything over to my higher power. I don't have to figure it out. And what's he going to do? He's going to remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. So I thought I had to give up my entire personality in 6 and 7. God's going to determine when he's going to remove it, and the thing is, God's going to use some of my defects. As you can see, I'm very matter-of-fact and professorial. I'm not dancing. It's not my thing. But you know, God's going to use me in the professorial way, which is not going to be useful to all people. I wish I was more gregarious like that. I wish I was more, I don't know if you guys know a lot of AA speakers. There's Chris Raymer, who's on one extreme, and then there's Peter Marinelli's on another extreme. I always wanted to be Peter Marinelli, and I'm much more Chris R. And I remember telling someone that. He said, we already have a Chris R. and a Peter M. How about just being Kim G.? So that's what this is being. I don't have to figure it out anymore. But I don't want to be blocked from you. And sometimes my defects allow me to connect with you. Because we both might have the same defects, and my defect in me might touch the defect in you. It is our wounds that bind us more than anything else. So it says here, grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Why do I need strength? Because I don't know how to act. I'm so used to relying on these defects. I don't know what to do now. So here's where I'm going to say, you're going to hear people, different teachers too, talk about it differently. What has worked for me is that this is only two paragraphs. I've seen this so complicated up. I have seen formats where they have 100 defects with 100 opposites. And if that works for you, go for it. I know people that really works for them. But man, I am so like all over the place. That just confuses the heck out of me. It's like playing whack-a-mole. I'm just doing that. We were taught four defects in the fourth step. I'm selfish, I'm dishonest, I'm self-seeking, and I'm frightened. Now what I can do is I can combine some of them, and maybe it comes out as passive aggression, maybe it comes out as a fear of abandonment, maybe it comes out as family of origin issues, and I can put these fancy names on it. But basically I'm being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. It's just a lot simpler for me to do that. Now when someone tells me, well, I'm going to put the defect on this side, and here's the asset, and I'm going to practice the asset, to me that's playing God. Listen, if I'm dishonest, I'm not an idiot. I know I'm supposed to be honest. I don't have the power to do that. That's why I'm in a 12-step program. I remember hearing an AA speaker say, you know, in religion, they tell you, here are the principles, do them. In AA, they say, here are the principles. You don't have the power to do them. So what, to me, 6 and 7 is I acknowledge my dishonesty and I ask God to remove it. And if God removes it, I will naturally become honest. I don't have to work on my defects. I don't have to try to make it happen. I don't have to act as if anymore, any of that stuff. I just ask God into it. And when I naturally grow into whatever the asset might happen to be. And it's just a lot simpler for me. Like I said, if your sponsor says it differently, if you feel it resonates with you differently, go for it. I am so results driven. Just for people who maybe were like me that were doing that and it was confusing you, I just love the simplicity of just those four defects. So it's just two paragraphs. Now, ironically, most of my step 10 work is step 6 and 7. Because in step 10, I'm going to be asked to watch, not work on, watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and my fear. So what happens for me is I have not had the allergy triggered in 7.5 years. What I'm powerless over today is my selfishness and my dishonesty, my resentment and my fear. My 6 and 7 becomes my step 1 for life. This is where I'm powerless over. And then I ask God to intercede in step 10 and remove that, and I grow towards these ideals that I have set.
Could you repeat that one more time?
Probably not. What?
Just the last thing that you said.
Six and seven becomes the step 1 of life, because these are now the things I'm powerless over because I'm a human being. So I'm going to read something now from Bill Wilson. This was in a grapevine. It says, a letter from a group in Chicago was mailed to Bill W. in 1960, taking his inventory. This was Bill's response. Bill was 26 years sober at the time. That you seem disillusioned with me personally may be a new and painful experience for you, but many members have had that experience with me. Most of their pain has been caused not only by my several shortcomings, but their own insistence on placing me, a drunk, trying to get along with other folks upon a completely illusionary pedestal, a station which no fallible person could possibly occupy. I'm sure that you will understand that I have never held myself out to anybody as either a saint or a Superman. I have repeatedly and truthfully said that AA is full of people who have made more spiritual progress than I ever have or can make. That is some areas of living I have made some decided gains, but in others I seem to have stood still. And in still others, I may have gone backwards. I am sorry that you are disillusioned with me, but I am happy that even I have found a life here. And I just think that's so beautiful. There's definitely people I look up to in OA and AA, but I try to remember that. Me putting anyone on a pedestal is not fair to them, too. You know, I found out recently that one of Bill's, I forget who it was now, there was a priest that Bill was really his mentor towards the end, and he considered converting to Catholicism. But he was afraid that if he did that, it was like AA was endorsing Catholicism. So he sacrificed that so that all of us would know that we can take whatever spiritual path we want to take. That's humility. That is absolute humility. So 6 and 7 is totally about humility, because I am admitting that these are the things that are blocking me and I don't have the power to do it, and I'm going to ask God into it. And then we have step 8, that next paragraph. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith... Oh, you know what I forgot? Can someone bring up the questions in the Ask It basket for me, please? Yeah, thank you. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We've made a list of all people we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Thank you. So step 8 is simply making a list of every person, institution, and principle we have put on our step 4. I don't know about you guys, but I used to go be in step groups. We would burn our fourth step. Like, how am I going to make a list in step 8 if I'm burning it in 6 and 7? You know? And once again, just another prejudice. When I look at the steps on the wall, I notice they're not here, but I always think, a lot of AA means you have the steps on the wall. What my brain does logically is it says that, well, if there's 12 steps, each of them must take equal amount of time and equal amount of effort, right? The way the big book describes it, you do 5, 6, 7, 8 all in one day. Now, some people don't do that, and if you find it works for you another way, I'm not saying not to do it, but the big book is telling us that. It is so beautiful that we don't have to sit in 5, 6, 7, 8 for all, I don't even know how you stay in step six for like a year. I don't get it. But that's the beauty of this step work, is it gets us through it. The momentum is building and building and building. So 5, 6, 7, and 8, according to the big book instructions, is all done in one day. So I'm going to go over questions now. And then after the next break, we're going to do steps nine, because we didn't make 8. Wow, a lot of questions. Holy moly. Okay. Do you have to report your food to be abstinent? How do you sponsor about the food? Is the best way to tell your sponsor what you are going to eat every day? Do you have to do that in order to be abstinent? You don't have to do that in order to be abstinent, because abstinence is defined by abstaining from those foods, those ingredients, and those behaviors which create the phenomenon of craving. I can just tell you personally, I do require my sponsees to commit their food up through step 10, because that's when they become unblocked. And then I let them decide where they want to continue. Some continue to commit their food, some don't. It's not because, and obviously this is not in the big book, because it's about alcohol. But I don't want people having to make food decisions all day. What am I going to eat? 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 I want that conversation shut down so they can focus on their recovery and on their life. So I ask them each day before they take that first bite, before they have their first meal, is to commit their food. The other benefit I find is if you're doing that, then suddenly you know, oh my gosh, I'm short on fruit, I'm short on vegetables, and you know you have to go to the grocery store. If you're planning, oh my God, I have to work overtime tomorrow, I better bring my lunch and my dinner to work. Oh my God, I'm going to have lunch with my mother. Okay, we're going to this diner. Let me just check the menu and see what I'm going to eat. So to me, it's just a way that while you're vulnerable in that in the beginning of abstinence, that you can help with that planning. So I am not checking and in critiquing people's food. What I'm doing is I'm helping them create disciplines so that they can focus on their step work. Do you take your sponsee's fifth step all at once or a section at a time, resentment, fear, and sex? The big book says we sit down for a big talk. So to me, I do it all in one time. I have to tell you the benefit for me. What I feel my job is to help people see the patterns, help them see where they're selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in all these different areas. If I'm getting it in sections, I can't see the patterns because I'm not hearing enough. So I know people will do that. I'll tell you my concern, once again, my opinion. I've seen people get so emotionally caught up as they're giving 4 or 5 resentments a day. They're doing a, you know, they're talking for 8 hours this Saturday and next, they're going to talk in 8 hours. Once again, this might be selfish on my point. If someone's staying in a 4-step for 7 to 10 days, my average 5th step is an hour and a half. That's very manageable. I got to tell you personally, over 2.5 hours, I can't even pay attention to what you're saying. It's exhausting. So it helps me be more efficient with helping people to keep it that short. But as a sponsor, I just find it's easier if we do it all in one sitting because then I can see the connections between resentment, fear, and sex conduct that I wouldn't see if it was piecemealed. But that said, just people who feel differently. And if it's working for you and you're finding freedom, disregard what I said. It was helpful to me when you said use God as a generic term, yet I bristle every time I hear him. Can you speak to letting go of my prejudgment about this or something from your experience, others who may have had this issue? I think that's a very common issue. I think it's a common issue in the big book in general. This was written in the 30s. It was very much a different time where everything was more catered to a male-dominated society. You know, the only thing I can say is I got to the point that I didn't care. Whatever the these and the thous, I still have a hard time with. I often will not read those words because it gets too Bible-ish for me, and my prejudices pop up. But if you are going to die or do the work, then look past the hymns. Look past the word God. And maybe they'll stop bothering you. Maybe they won't. Like I said, it's a dimmer switch. But that's a great question to have with some people, too. What role do boundaries play in your recovery? Okay, I'm gonna admit one of my prejudices, because I have the psych degree. Psych terms drive me crazy. I remember being in a meeting, though, with one of my AA mentors, and the person talked about creating boundaries. And he said, I don't know. Creating boundaries sounds an awful lot like managing your own life. And that's what I find for me. So we're going to talk about 10 and 11. When I get into 10 and 11 and I'm asking God into what I should be doing and God's directing me, it feels a lot more authentic to me than me trying to decide what boundary I need to make. Because usually when I make a boundary, it's out of fear, it's out of anger, and it's out of I feel threatened and I'm going to try to control this situation. Now, I might come to the same conclusion from step 11, but I'm doing it through a peaceful way of doing it versus a fearful way of doing it. But once again, if it works for you to create boundaries and you're finding contentment, then use that terminology. I'm just telling you, for me, that terminology just kind of twists me because of my psychology background, which I've never used, except to annoy people. I have done at least 10 4-step inventories. How will this one be any different? I don't know who wrote this, but once again, the inventory process is 4 through 9. So if you've done 10 fourth steps but never gone through 4 through 9, it's going to be a totally different experience. Where you are today is different than the last time you did a 4th step. So you're going to be doing a 4th step on what's going on today. Anything that I always tell people, especially people who come from AA and are now doing it in OA, I tell them, if you resolve something in AA, if you resolve something through therapy, don't put it down. It's not blocking with you if you resolve it. You're looking at what is taking up rent in your head today. So that's how it should be different today, is because of what is blocking you today versus rehashing things that you've already resolved. Okay. You guys are good with the questions. You describe more inventory columns than I've heard of before. It sounded like fear was broken into its own matrix. Can you offer us a template picture of what this matrix looks like, please? There is formats that I use, but is there not OA approved? So I can share with you guys with that separately. There are 1,000 different formats. To me, as long as it aligns with the big book, whether you have 4 columns or 5 columns, whether you have it, your fear is exactly like your resentments, and I know people that do sex and other harms as well, I don't think it really matters. It's all trying to get us down to what's blocking us from our higher power. So my feeling is whatever your sponsor is telling you to do, as long as it's coming from the big book, don't worry that if you don't do it with the same number of columns or the same exact format, that you're not going to get the benefit from it. Because it is getting to selfishness, resentment, fear, self-seeking. That's what's going to give you that experience. Why don't vision meetings mention? I'm not a representative of vision, so I'm not going to answer any questions about vision specifically. I'm here as a member of Overeaters Anonymous, not a member of vision. I have resentment regarding the fact that in order to stay abstinent for the rest of my life, I have so much work to do. For example, extensive food prep, having to bring food to places, etc. How do I reconcile this part of my recovery with the fact that I do it the rest of my life? I don't know how, but you better. You know, same way, once again, I have to accept that I have this broken ankle. I'm twisting my ankle right now underneath. I don't know if you can tell because my ankle's starting to tighten up. I don't have an option to pretend I don't have a broken ankle. I don't have an option to pretend that I don't get sunburn if I go out in there. I have to fully concede. I always use the example, all you guys that are wearing glasses or contacts, did you decide, thinking, I'm going away to Colorado, maybe I won't wear my glasses today, or it's my birthday, I don't want to wear my glasses? You fully concede to yourself that you have a vision problem, and therefore your glasses correct that, and that's what you have to do. And I don't think you go to the delusion that you're going to outgrow it. And most likely you're going to have to get a new prescription because your vision is going to get worse. That's part of this process, fully conceding. What I can tell you is when I packed for this trip, that my preparation for my food and my preparation for the fact that I'm pale and I'm going to get sunburned, I did with equally acceptance and no resentment. Yes, there's extra stuff I have to do because I'm a compulsive overeater, but there's a lot of stuff extra I have to do for other reasons as well. I do not fly well. I have to do a lot of extra weird things because of my flying, because I tend to throw up. And I did not throw up this time, but we'll see what happens on the way back because I'm feeling the altitude sickness now, so I'm afraid I might throw up on the way home. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. What do you think of gray sheet abstinence? I don't know. Does anybody know what gray sheet is? This is something before. I remember. So my mom came in the 70s, and I think there were 3 sheets, wasn't there? It was a gray, an orange, and one other color, blue. So back then, OA had these food plans that were out. I think the gray was the most popular because people lost weight the fastest on it. And then OA made the decision to not endorse any specific food plan, so those kind of disappeared. But there's actually a separate 12-step fellowship now called Gray Sheet Anonymous. There's also a separate 12-step fellowship that actually purchased the gray sheet from OA, and they're called CHOW. I don't have an opinion on it, but I'll tell you what my concern is. If it doesn't hit your binge foods, you're not abstinent. And you might be abstaining from things that you don't need to abstain from because they don't trigger your allergy. So I think any group, personally, that says that the membership in that group, you have to eat exactly like everybody else, is not helpful for the compulsive overeater because I could be abstaining from things that I don't need to and I could be eating things that are triggering the allergy and going to keep me in the disease. Does that make sense? Okay. We are after 4:00, so we're going to take a break now, and I will continue with the questions before we do step 9, and we will be back in 5 minutes.